A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm delighted to share the rest of the second series is once again in partnership with Heck. Being an independent and family-owned business, they pull out all the stops to bring that farmer's market quality to the supermarket shelf. In addition to their delicious original range, they offer veggie options too, catering for absolutely everyone, all of which can be found online at heckfood.co.uk and in the major supermarkets too. Hello, and thank you so much for tuning in to Food for Thought, a podcast on a mission to equip you with all the evidence-based advice you need to live and breathe a healthy lifestyle. I'm Rhiannon Lambert, a registered nutritionist, master practitioner, best-selling author of Renourish, A Simple Way to Eat Well, and founder of Retrition, London's leading private nutrition clinic. In each episode of this second series, I'll be joined by special guests, all of whom can be considered authorities in the world of well-being, so that together we can learn fact from fiction and empower the healthiest versions of ourselves with trusted expert advice. Although we can't always see it, it seems we can't avoid it. Pollution is increasingly cited as one of the world's biggest threats to health. It's there when we step outside for some supposed fresh air. It's present throughout our commute to work. It can even be found in our very own homes. So, should we fear pollution? And is there really anything we can do to avoid it? Joining me today to understand more about the real impact of pollution is Dr. Matthew Loxham, a fellow in respiratory biology and air pollution toxicology at the University of Southampton. Hello, Matthew.
Hello.
Thank you so much for coming on today. There's a lot to discuss with pollution, and I hope we can get through it all.
Fingers crossed. See how we go.
I mean, with the World Health Organization suggesting that pollution is a major cause of death and disease globally, is it really as bad as it sounds?
I think there's two factors here. I think the main factor is that we're learning more and more about how air pollution's affecting us. So the estimates are going up. You know, in the 2000s, we were thinking maybe 1 or 2 million people were having deaths that were brought earlier by air pollution. Now the figure's gone up to 8, maybe 9 million. That's not because more people are being affected by it, but because we're understanding so much more, but also we're still understanding more. So I suspect those figures are going to carry on increasing, even though actually globally, pollution's going down slightly.
Well, it's interesting you say globally, because obviously we'd associate it maybe here with faraway cities like Beijing and China, but it definitely does affect towns and villages, of course, too, surely.
Of course, it depends where you are. We do associate it with these faraway cities where there's a lot of industrialisation. And in a way, it's a bit like in this country in the late 19th and early 20th century, when we had factories everywhere burning coal and we had smog.
The Industrial Revolution.
Exactly. And London in the early 50s, the London smog, and you know, that stands in history as kind of the first major air pollution event that was really studied. But actually in this country, we're still exposed to pollution. It's from different sources. Okay. So instead of being big factories and big coal burning power stations, now we have wood burning stoves, we have diesel cars. So it's changed. And of course, what we're exposed to here is less than what people might be exposed to in Shanghai, for example. But that doesn't mean there's no effect at all.
Well, no, because I was looking at doing some research, and an environmental charity called Friends of the Earth, they reported that air pollution now exceeds safety limits in almost 2,000 locations across the UK.
So I really hate these safety limits.
Here we go.
So there's two limits. So there's the European Union, okay, at least for the next couple of weeks.
Oh, gosh. I don't know when this podcast is out, but who knows what will be. We won't bring up the B word.
We'll see what happens. But the European Union has legal limits on various pollutants, both for an annual average and a shorter term exposure. Mm. And then the World Health Organization has a guideline level, which isn't legally enforced. But it's notable that in a lot of cases, the World Health Organization recommendations are much lower than the EU. And actually, the EU levels are much lower than other organizations elsewhere in the world.
Okay.
So these limits, they don't represent safe levels. We know, in fact, that there are health effects below EU limits. So even if you're breathing what is classed as safe air, it's not. But they're set kind of pragmatically based on what's doable, what's feasible, without damaging the economy and making everyone who works in industry homeless, for example.
So of course.
It's a difficult balancing act.
No, I'm really pleased you've shared that, because that we can obviously, when we're not educated in this area, it's very easy to be scared with these statistics. And when it comes to being scared, I mean, I know we're only just at the beginning of discovering the true extent of pollution, but I did read something last week. Here we go again. I read it in the European Heart Journal, and it suggested that the number of early deaths caused worldwide by pollution is 8.8 million a year. And that's after a few comparisons. So they found that toxic air is killing more people than tobacco smoking. I mean, is that true?
Okay, so the first thing is the use of the word caused.
Yes.
So it's more of an association, and we would say associated. Basically, statistically, if those 8.8 million people had not been exposed to air pollution, statistically, they would probably have died less early than they did. Uh-huh. They may well have died anyway. Okay, so it's not people who have gone outside, taken a breath and died. And also, we can't be sure that it's causative. So we can't be sure that the pollution's causing that. Although the amount of evidence that's out there suggests that it probably is in a large part causing it.
Okay.
But certainly, it's affecting particularly people with pre-existing disease.
Of course.
These aren't people who have been perfectly healthy, gone outside and had a heart attack.
No.
They're people mainly with underlying disease who are affected by air pollution.
Yeah.
But it does certainly affect a very large number of people, both in a way that they can't tell, perhaps ways that we can measure scientifically, but that they don't understand. But also, there are spikes in death rates when pollution spikes severely, maybe more than we'd see in this country, but there are associations.
That's so interesting. I'm glad you've kind of nailed the causation versus association kind of factor, because of course, if we're talking about heart disease, I mean, lifestyle interventions are huge anyway when it comes to diet and activity. There's a lot of factors that could predispose someone to an increased risk anyway. And looking at things like the tube, this is something I've always been very heavily fascinated by. And I know a lot of people that perhaps follow me on social media at Retrition, they will know that I'm constantly dreading my journey to the tube every morning. Is it true that if you use the tube or you're traveling for just under an hour, it could expose you to as much air pollution as spending an entire day on a busy road?
Yes, but there are very big buts with that.
Good.
So this is in terms of something called PM2.5, which we sometimes call fine particulate matter. So it's airborne dust.
Yeah.
2.5 microns in diameter. So that's, off the top of my head, about 0.04 millimeter.
Wow.
So it's small enough to get deep into your lungs.
Yeah.
And it's associated with a range of health effects. And the depending where you are, the average PM2.5 level outside, you might expect somewhere between 10 and 20.
Mm-hmm.
In the London Underground, the most recent measurements suggest around 500. Okay, so 500 versus 10 or 20, so 30 times higher. So for every 30 hours you're spending outside, is the same exposure as 1 hour on the ground.
It's like you've just dropped the biggest awful knowledge bomb in the studio right now.
Okay, but, and there's a very big but here. So the first but is what the particles are made of.
Okay.
So when you look at particles underground, they're really metallic, which you'd expect perhaps if you think about what's generating them.
Course.
They come from the wheels and the rails and the trains. Outside, a lot of the particles are from car exhaust and from burning things.
Mm.
And actually, if you look at, and there aren't many of them, if you look at the studies of health effects of air pollution in underground stations on people's health, it does have some measurable effects on the lungs in terms of short exposures.
Mm.
But actually, there's no evidence to suggest that long-term exposure necessarily makes your health worse than if you weren't in the underground. And that's mainly on studies done on people who work actually in the Swedish underground.
Okay.
There are a few reasons to think that that's not enough evidence. So these are all healthy people. They tend to be male. They tend to be middle-aged.
Yeah.
And actually, air pollution we know affects predominantly people who have issues with other...
Yeah,
exactly. Very young, very old, pre-existing health conditions. But I think the jury's out. I think all I'd say is we need to do quite a lot more research on it.
Mm.
But if you're asking me how I get around when I'm in London... predominantly the tube.
Ah, okay.
But then
okay.
I'm a healthy middle-aged male, so
yeah.
Draw your own conclusions.
No, that's really reassuring to hear, because I'd read something else that around 28,000 to 36,000 deaths a year are attributed to long-term exposure of pollution.
That's in the UK.
Okay.
And again, those are deaths, premature deaths. So these are not people who, if they hadn't been exposed to air pollution, would have lived another 30 or 40 years necessarily.
Yeah.
It's just, it's a bit like if you say to someone that if they don't eat fruit or veg, they will have a shorter lifespan.
Yeah.
No one dies because they don't have an apple one day.
No.
It's the same kind of thing.
It's so true. In fact, I find most, as a nutritionist, most of my life, I'm trying to dispel the myth that if you just eat one item of food, you're suddenly going to become healthy.
Yeah.
It's your overall lifestyle, as with everything.
Yes.
Yeah, but knowing you take the tube, Matthew, has reassured me that, yes, I can. I will continue with my commute. So why is pollution so damaging to our bodies? What actually happens when we breathe in those toxins? What's the mechanism?
Okay, so the first point of contact for pollution is the lungs.
Yes.
Okay, so every time you breathe in, depending on how you breathe in, you either breathe through your nose if you're at rest,
mm-hmm.
Or you breathe through your mouth, and the pollution goes... up your nose, maybe. And,
yeah.
and most of what I work on is the particles, so the dust particles. So if we focus on those.
Yeah,
for the moment.
So dust particles.
So dust particles. If you breathe through your nose, most of them get trapped in the nostrils, in the hairs, in the
Well, the protective barriers,
the nasal mucus.
Microbiome area around your body. Yeah.
Exactly. Some of it gets into your lungs, more of it gets into your lungs if you breathe through your mouth.
Mm.
When it gets there, it usually settles in the windpipe or in the tubes, the bronchioles, which lead down to the bottom of the lungs. Most of it gets trapped in mucus, coughed up, and you swallow it. And
which is why there's especially that London association with black snot.
Exactly. Yeah, and actually, that can be measured. You can measure what we call black carbon. Is there's a way of measuring it?
Oh, but, gosh.
I mean, we don't measure it in snot, but you can measure it in the air. Yeah. So these particles, depending on their size, get to an extent into the airways.
Mm.
If they do manage to contact cells, they can cause irritation to the cells, and they do that by generating what we call reactive oxygen species, which are kind of really reactive molecules that contain oxygen.
Yeah.
I suppose perhaps the most well-known one to the public will probably be hydrogen peroxide, which can be generated by these particles.
Mm.
That can cause irritation to the airway, so it can cause inflammation. You can get immune cells, which are white blood cells, coming into the airway as a response, which in some people they might, even in high levels of pollution, they might just experience a slight cough or a wheeze or
similar to
irritation.
Hay fever. I do find this a lot, that I find a lot of clients, I myself, and this is obviously very anecdotal, but when I moved to London, I developed what's similar to hay fever. I never had it back in the country.
Yep, so itchy eyes, or sometimes runny eyes, runny nose, scratchy throat, exactly the same.
Yeah.
And that's in healthy people. Mm. But what you can also do, you can measure what we call lung function, the ability to inhale oxygen, inhale air, and that tends to drop. So your lungs don't work quite as well.
Yeah.
But maybe you wouldn't notice that. But then there are also effects on the cardiovascular system. So actually the strongest links of air pollution are to heart disease and stroke and heart attack.
Yes, I've been reading about that. Yeah.
And so we think we know how that occurs, but there's different mechanisms. So one of them is that the particles might actually be able to get into the bloodstream, get around the body.
Mm.
One is that they might cause these inflammatory processes in the lungs, which then release chemicals into the blood, which then cause those inflammatory responses and perhaps effects on the nervous system as well.
Okay.
So different mechanisms for effects, but it is particularly the cardiovascular system. But we're also now seeing associations, and again, association rather than
cause
with type 2 diabetes, dementia, loss of, I guess, what we call cognitive performance. So a lesser
neurodegenerative type of disease.
Yeah, but also a lesser ability to do well in say, verbal reasoning tests, for example. And that's been shown last year in a study in China, which was really quite nicely designed.
Yeah.
Effects that actually healthy people probably wouldn't notice, but are measurable.
Mm.
But of course, then the people who've already got heart disease or asthma, more likely to have episodes of exacerbations of those diseases. And that's when it becomes a problem.
Yeah. Obviously, we need a lot more research in these areas, but it's extremely fascinating. And I think that I understand that pollution is obviously more about exposure, and that's because of how close we are maybe to the traffic or where we live perhaps as well. But one thing that's always concerned me living in London at the moment in particular, or if anyone's listening out there, if you live in a city, if you are a mum of a young child or a baby, does it impact the child? Let's say if you have a pram and the child is at the same height of a car exhaust and you're walking down roads, surely because the child will have smaller lungs or something along that degree, what I'm trying to say is it damaging to a child's health to be exposed like that?
So, first of all, children in general, their lungs are still developing, and air pollution can reduce the degree to which they develop, which can be improved by moving them away from the pollution, and that their lungs can kind of regain that lost lung function. But once they reach the age where their lungs would normally be fully developed, it's kind of locked in. Okay. But that's children in general. If you're talking specifically about prams and pushchairs near the road, there's a colleague of mine in at the University of Surrey, Prashant Kumar, who's done some really nice work with this, where they actually put a load of pollution monitoring devices in a pram.
Oh, great. Okay.
Walked around Guildford with it.
Great. I bet
probably
that was
got
fun.
Some strange looks.
I'm sure.
And they found that actually the children or that the devices in the pram were exposed to different levels of certainly particulate matter, which is what they were looking at, compared to the parents.
The
sometimes it was more, sometimes it was less. But they've also looked at all the other work that's been done in this area. And it does seem that if children are within about a metre of the ground, what they call the breathing zone, where the mouth is, if they're near the ground, they do tend to breathe in more particulate matter. And that could potentially have effects on their lungs, which, just considering the parents who were taller, you wouldn't necessarily see. I would say there's not enough to draw really firm conclusions, but it would certainly make me think about what children are being exposed to and ways in which potentially that exposure can be reduced.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I think it's really a good, important take home for anyone listening that perhaps if they avoid the main road and they maybe take the parallel road that's just even a little bit behind and less busy, that could help.
Agreed. There is evidence that if you take a road that's parallel but literally just 10 or 20 metres back, it can reduce your exposure to certain pollutants by 50% sometimes.
Yeah.
That was actually some work done in London, actually, by King's College.
Because I believe you worked on something last year, didn't you, that was to do with the tubes or different mapping of the polluted routes in London?
So I originally used to work on underground trains, although not in London. Somewhere.
Okay.
I'm not allowed to say where it was.
Okay.
But not in London.
Yeah.
But I haven't actually really done any work on streets as such, although what I do now is more related to ships and ports and road traffic and what comes out of them.
Yeah.
But going back to your question about walking near the road, certainly I would say walking on a parallel, quieter street is an easy win, if you like. It's an easy way to reduce your pollution exposure without having any, inconvenience to your everyday life.
Yeah, because you mentioned there as well, obviously working on different fields like planes and ships and different pollutants that affect the environment. And obviously we've got manufacturing going on, we've got construction happening. Out of all of these, what causes the biggest problem? I mean, it seems like we're never going to be in a place where there's no cars, so no one's just going to be walking and cycling everywhere at this rate.
It depends where you are, depends when you are, and I suppose it depends what you mean by problem. So certainly in cities over the past 20 or 30 years, it's been the car that's been thought of as being the major issue.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, a properly tuned Euro 6, which is the best emission standard diesel car, actually performing as it should.
Yeah.
And there are some issues with that. If it's performing as it should, the exhaust emissions should not be particularly high compared to what they used to be.
Okay.
What we're becoming more worried about is what we call non-exhaust emissions, so the brake wear, the road wear, the tire wear, so things that come
up. I hadn't even thought of those.
Yeah. And actually, as electric cars get heavier because the battery adds weight, you may get more of some of those particles generated, and we don't really understand their effect. So research is starting into that.
Right.
As cars become maybe slightly less important, or at least the exhaust from cars, wood burning has gone up. So a lot of people now, I don't remember it from 10 or 20 years ago, but you see adverts for wood stoves that people can have in their houses, and it's really nice wood burner.
Yeah. Well, I've lived in London too long where you can't have any of that in your flat, so.
Exactly. But I've noticed over the past couple of winters, you walk past people's houses and you smell, you think, oh, someone burning wood or leaves, and it's their house. And this can account for 30, maybe 40% of particulate matter in certain urban areas. And, you know, this is actually, unlike cars, where some people need a car, and I'm not defending all car use, but sometimes it's necessary. But I don't really see any need for wood stoves whatsoever. There are some stoves that claim to be lower emissions, and I don't really know how true those claims are. I think a lot of it depends on what you put in the stove. But really, there's no need for a wood stove.
What about gas hobs?
So gas hobs can also give off, you know, cooking. It's a major source of indoor emissions and indoor pollutants.
I wanted to touch on that. Yeah, indoor pollutants. I just feel like, what is there in the home that we should be aware of then? What is the, is it scented candles? Oh, really? Okay, so
I have to say, this is not my main area of expertise.
That's all right, that's okay.
I think we do know much less about it in general than we know about outdoor pollution.
Yeah.
But, okay, so if we think about paints, varnishes, you know, you think of, what else? There are chemicals that leach out of fire-resistant foams that you get in your furniture.
Oh, wow. Any
plastics, plasticizers, they can leach out.
Don't get me started on plastic.
Cooking, especially cooking at high temperatures. So if people char grill things, but stir frying as well gives off huge amounts of particles, both from the oil and from the food and from the flame itself.
Of course.
Candles, air fresheners, deodorants, aerosols.
So there's obviously not enough going on to discuss this, because you've just listed, I would say, at least 20 things in the house, and that's at least, I say. I've heard of certain companies, one particularly springs to mind, having indoor kind of extractor devices that clean the air. How accurate are those? Because I've even got one at home.
So I can't, I don't know the full extent of what their claims are and also how valid those claims are.
Right.
I've got no reason to think the claims aren't valid.
No, it's quite an innovative brand.
It is. I think there's a couple of issues. I think one issue is air pollution is a societal problem, and it's known that people at the poorer end of society, I mean, we usually say socioeconomic but the poorer end of society tend to have worse air quality. They emit less, but they are exposed more. And these devices can be quite expensive. So there's an issue of whether we're really making protection from pollution something that's societally stratified, if you like, where only richer people can afford to breathe cleaner. There's also, I suppose, the question of what happens to the filters? And I was there's a professor at Leeds, Ali Lewis, who wrote an article about this on the internet last week. And he made the very valid point that if you have these filters that are sucking in air and filtering out all the particles, which you know, are probably quite toxic in small amounts, and they're concentrating them all on a filter, and then we chuck that filter in the bin and it goes to landfill, all of the dirt and all of the chemicals from that filter are ending up in the landfill. What's happening
to the landfill?
To it then? And also, what about the filters? I'm not sure what they're made of, but are they generating particles that themselves get into the air?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
I mean, certainly, you know, HEPA-filtered air, which is what people in these sort of clean laboratories, where you see them on the TV wearing all these bodies. HEPA-filtered air is much, much, much cleaner than air outside. I think we're looking at the wrong target, if I'm brutally honest.
Okay.
And also in this country, you know, I think if I lived in China, maybe I would.
Yeah.
In this country, I think it's the wrong target.
Okay.
I think we should be looking at the emissions rather than trying to scoop out of the air what's in our house. Also, you know, unless you've got your window closed, if you've got your window open, then effectively you're trying to cool.
What about if you live by a main road?
Yeah, so this is a question about whether, you know, is it better
to
have your
shut it or open it?
that's a very good question.
I know.
And I don't know the answer, in all honesty. I don't know that it's ever really been.
We don't have the solutions yet, do we, either? I think it's one of these overwhelming problems. We're now starting to talk about pollution. We're talking about plastic. We're talking about all these things that we know we need to do something about. And it's almost like, how do we start?
Yep, exactly.
Where do we start? And I guess, as a nutritionist, my main interest is on food. So There's a two-way relationship between food production and air pollution, isn't there? I mean, when it comes to significantly polluted air, does it impact the food in any way? If you're growing crops in an area that's got a main road next to it, or if you're eating a diet, for instance, some studies have said if you eat a diet rich in meat, dairy and eggs, that you'll produce more greenhouse gases. What are your views on that area?
Certainly, and again, this is really not my main area of expertise, but you know, dairy produce, meat consumption is certainly linked to greenhouse gas production, which may have more of an effect on the environment than it does on health, perhaps. For example, methane. You
know, yes.
Methane is a very potent greenhouse
gas.
In terms of the effect of pollution on food, I'm not entirely sure.
Okay.
And especially if you're growing things like the roadside, I'm not really sure whether
it
would have any effect.
I think we need to study that. I would love to see.
But there are, you know, there are, going back to where I work on ships have ways of cleaning their exhaust, which effectively involves spraying water across it.
Okay.
And they're not meant to, but sometimes they dump that water that's been used to clean the exhaust into the sea. And then if any fish eat that, then potentially you're accumulating those toxins in the food chain, potentially. But in terms of in this country and what we do with our food, I really don't know that there's any evidence out there, or at least if there is, I haven't seen it.
Obviously, I get asked a lot about what kind of things can you eat in your diet to protect you from various things. And we know that it's not that simple. But is there actually any research that suggests that certain types of food can protect you from pollution levels?
So going back to when I talked about reactive oxygen species and oxidants causing which cause some of the health effects of air pollution, it's possible that eating a diet that's not deficient, at least in antioxidants, so vitamin C, vitamin E particularly, could protect us, although there is some evidence that taking a high dose of vitamin C only causes a very brief increase in the amount of vitamin C in your lungs. So I think it's a question of what you're putting in versus what the actual effect is. There's also an antioxidant called resveratrol.
Yes,
people always go on about the one that you get in red wine
and grapes. Yeah,
so red grapes. So when people say, "Oh, it's all right, wine, red wine, it's got resveratrol," and so is red grape juice.
Yeah, I know.
And then there's a chemical called sulforaphane, which acts as it basically activates within our cells a master switch for generating antioxidants. Mm. So you think, "Oh, that'd be great to take sulforaphane."
Yes.
Sulforaphane is found in cruciferous vegetables, so broccoli, sprouts, and so on. The problem is that as far as I'm aware, you'd have to eat about 30 to 40 kilos of broccoli to get that effect.
And
then your greenhouse gas emissions would be probably shoot through the roof. So, these are things that in theory might be good according to how we know air pollution works. But I suspect actually in real life situations, getting enough of them into our body and for them then to get to the right place in our body is a bit of a big ask.
For what you've just said as well, this hammers home the message I'm always banging on about, is that we're all unique and everything in moderation, because we need more fruit and vegetables in our diet. Ultimately, the more antioxidants, the more vitamins, the more minerals, the better. And not from supplement form for anyone listening. If we're talking about bioavailability, it's always going to be better if you eat it instead. So, but who is more at risk of pollution? So we've mentioned, obviously, if you're predisposed to a certain condition, would it be the elderly or perhaps pregnant women? Are there any specific kind of groups?
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I think if you're saying more, I think it's difficult to quantify it. People are differentially at risk. So certainly people with severe underlying respiratory and cardiovascular disease are known to be at risk. And you know, when you, especially when you see a spike in air pollution, there's notable increases in the number of people who have to go to hospital for asthma attacks, for heart attacks, for strokes, usually somewhere between 1 and 3 days after the pollution spike. But we're talking about spikes here that are really high. So
when
we're not,
you say a spike, just so the listeners know, is that when the, is it the PM, the particle matters, is this more of them present?
It's when there's a lot more in the air. Yeah. And the studies that usually look at that tend to look at events like forest fires. And it's especially, I suppose it's especially easy to look at in places like Australia and Indonesia, Philippines, where they have either accidental or managed forest fires that do cause very steep increases. Here, I'd say the closest we probably get to is bonfire night.
Okay. Oh, you can smell it in London.
Yeah. Now, I'm not really aware of much research. There's been a bit of research done that suggests that those particles on bonfire night might be more toxic. They might be able to generate more of these reactive oxygen species, but I've not seen any studies that show a definitive increase in any health effects after bonfire night. But going back to 1950s, when there was the great smog in London in December 1952, there was a massive increase in smoke, massive increase in sulfur dioxide, which is the gas you get from coal burning. At the same time, a massive increase in death rate. The smoke and the sulfur dioxide went down quite quickly. The death rate took a lot longer to go back to the level it was at. So we can track these episodes, but I'd say in this country, it's that kind of thing's much less of a risk.
Yeah. Oh, it's so fascinating. I think people are starting to do something, though. I mean, most of the listeners would be living in London listening to this podcast, but should London folk be more worried, let's say? And because I know that London are bringing in the ultra low emission zone, the ULEZ to abbreviate, is now in place. And I'm wondering if you could tell us exactly what this means and whether it should be rolled out across the UK.
So London's had a low emission zone since I think it was first phasing in 2008, I think. And that was aimed at restricting emissions from larger goods vehicles. And it's done, again, on the basis of what I mentioned before about these Euro emission standards, which look at how much particulates and how much nitrogen dioxide a vehicle releases.
Yes.
The difference with the ultra-low emission zone is that it will affect cars, private vehicles, as well as the larger goods vehicles. And it will apply the most up-to-date emissions regulations to those cars. There is a big question mark about whether the emissions from a car as is measured in the testing scenario really mirrors what's going on when it's driving around the streets, and most of the evidence suggests it doesn't and it misses it by quite a long way. But whether it will have any effect, I'm not sure. Most of the evidence about low emission zones at the moment suggests that they have only a small effect on air quality.
Yeah.
And I've not seen any study on low emission zones that they have any real beneficial effect on health outcomes. There are some instances where local authorities have taken massive action to improve air quality. So two cases in point: Atlanta Olympics in 1996, Beijing Olympics 2008, where they had massive restrictions on traffic because right, you don't want your marathon runners keeling over in the middle of the street, right?
It
doesn't look too good on TV. but this kind of restriction, I think it will improve air quality. I'm not sure it will improve air quality as much as people predict.
Well, what about hybrid cars? I think that's another thing. They're saying that if you have a hybrid in London, then you can drive your car more. Is that correct?
Yeah, so hybrids are petrol rather than diesel, although there is, again, question marks about the newest diesel and how dirty they are compared to the newest petrol. And obviously hybrids are running on electric some of the time. I think really it's something where our previous estimates of what will happen versus what has happened have been so out of sync with each other that we just have to see.
Oh, gosh. So should we all be moving to the countryside?
So I was talking about this with a colleague the other day. People move out of the city because that's the aspiration, right? You can have a house in the countryside.
Well, it's kind of
and then everyone, well, everyone then wants to have the city life. So every day they drive into town, sit in traffic jams because they want to go to the cinema or the restaurants or see their friends.
Yeah.
So it's exactly the same, except everyone's living in the countryside. And eventually, if everyone moves to the countryside, you need all the local amenities.
Yeah.
So within a couple of decades, you've got a mini town. And then everyone wants to move out of the mini town. So,
okay, no, that's true. But what about if you compare the UK then to other countries? I mean, is the problem getting worse or better? Do we have any kind of data we can pull in there?
So concentrations of most air pollutants in this country are going down.
Ah.
And they have been going down for 10, 15, 20 years, depending on the pollutant.
Great.
As I said earlier, the effects on health seem to be going up. That's more because we know more about how pollution affects health.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at other countries, some countries' pollution levels are going up. Most of the global picture is improving slowly.
Yeah.
But again, because we know more about the effects, the total number of associated deaths and negative health outcomes is going up. Also, more people now are living in cities because they're exposed, and therefore they're exposed more to urban air pollution.
True.
So it's not just what's an average over the whole country, but actually what are people themselves breathing. And this is why our knowledge of actually the effects of air pollution is lacking, I guess. I mean, there's a lot of work out there, but the problem is, how do you work out what people are exposed to?
How do you quantify?
It's very, very difficult. At the moment, we have air pollution stations.
Yeah.
So they sit on the street. Unless you spend 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, sat next to that pollution station, that's not what you're breathing in.
No, of course, So it's very, very difficult to put on. And we can't just blame the government, can we? Is there anything that we can do as individuals to help improve our impact on the pollution levels?
Yes. So I think one of the main ones is I suppose what's now called active transport, so cycling and walking. And if you can't do those, public transport. And absolutely, there are sometimes some people or some circumstances where that just isn't possible and a car is necessary.
Well, even cycling next to a busy road of cars in London, it's quite dangerous.
It's very dangerous.
And you're probably inhaling a lot.
Well, there's some. Let's talk about dangerous bit first.
Okay.
So I personally used to cycle, and I don't cycle anymore for that very reason.
Yeah.
I walk, I don't own a car, but not so much for environmental reasons. But I don't cycle because it's dangerous. I think we want to improve air quality, but am I willing to potentially sacrifice my life for it?
No. Yeah.
So I think what we do need is separate cycle lanes where you have some kind of raised curb between them. And even better would be some greenery on that raised curb to act as a barrier.
Yes.
So going back to what you said about what we're inhaling, the people who are exposed to the very most air pollution are people who sit in cars. It's a bit of a misnomer. People say, I don't want to be exposed to pollution, therefore I'm going in my car. The air around you in a car, the air's getting sucked in. If you think where you are as a driver, you're right behind the car in front's exhaust pipe. So all the air's coming in. It can be round about 6 to 8 times more polluted in a car than it is outside.
Wow.
But then there's also the question of what you're inhaling. Because if you just sat there in a car, you're breathing not very fast, you're breathing not very deep. Whereas if you're really going for it on the bike, your ventilation is faster. It's also your tidal volume, so the amount of air you're breathing in is more.
Yes.
So actually, you're probably breathing in a little more air pollution than if you sit in the car. But then there's the physical benefits. And there's been some computer research done on computer modelling basis for this that suggests that in this country, and to be honest, in much of the Western world, however long you cycle, the health benefits will outweigh the damage from pollution.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily the same if you're in somewhere like Delhi or Beijing, where actually cycling for more than 30 to 45 minutes might be more damaging to your health than not doing any exercise.
Wow.
But in this country, the evidence is that the exercise, at least if you're healthy, I'm not talking about people with asthma.
No, of course.
But as long as you're healthy, the evidence is that the exercise is always better than the negative effects of the air pollution.
I agree. It kind of brings me back to my university days doing tidal volume and studies in labs with the
spirometers.
It came right back into my head. Okay, so we know what we can do to help, and getting moving helps. But one little fact I just wanted to question with you is that my clinic is on Harley Street. And with Oxford Street's pollutant levels supposedly breaching the EU's annual limit just 4 days into the year, I'm definitely walking through this kind of area every day. So I'm now going to take the park. So that would kind of be a better route. Even if it's longer to go to work, it's probably going to be more beneficial for me. But are those statistics accurate then? When we hear scaremongering headlines like that, as you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, should we be listening to these headlines?
So the limit that you're talking about is the number of times that a location can breach, I think what you're talking about at least, is the number of times a location can breach its daily average for nitrogen dioxide.
Yeah.
It might be hourly average, actually, I can't remember. I'm not sure that's true this year. I wouldn't. Okay. Is that this year's data?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. So it is breaching those levels. There's a really interesting study, or actually there's a couple of studies that were done where some researchers from King's College got people to walk down Oxford Street for 2 hours. And then they got another group of people to walk around Hyde Park for 2 hours. And then a couple of weeks later, they switched them over. So the Hyde Park group did Oxford Street and vice versa. And they found that walking down Oxford Street had, even though these people were healthy, had effects on their lungs, had effects on the cells that were in the fluid of their lungs when they looked within the lungs. Is it something you should be worried about? I'd say it's something that people should be aware of, especially people who might be at risk.
Mm.
You know, I think it's important if people have asthma, if people have
even
a mild cardiovascular disease, that they're aware of these pollution levels so that you know, if they need an inhaler, they can potentially use it if necessary.
Yeah, of course.
And I say that, you know, I'm not a medical doctor, so I can't tell people when to.
But
it's good to be aware of it.
Yeah, definitely.
But I suppose one of the other aspects of the question is this simply a consequence of the way we live in modern society? You know, how much of pollution comes from people wanting to get around to see friends or to go to the cinema on the bus or driving around because they want to get to places which, you know, if everyone lived in little communities, they wouldn't do that.
No,
so I suppose the question is, how much of the pollution is a necessary evil? How much of it can we target to reduce? Yeah. There's always going to be some air pollution, even if we got rid of all burning, all cars, or, you know, there would...
I mean, it'll be everywhere, even in hospitals. You know, people working in hospital environments, there'll be levels of pollution from different
even
things.
If you go to the Arctic, there's pollution.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't worry about it.
Okay.
I would be aware of it
and
let that awareness guide you as to choosing maybe the best route to walk to work and maybe helping you to decide to walk rather than use the car.
Yes, no, definitely. So that's going to be something I'm definitely taking away from this episode. Now, we have lots of questions that I've been putting out there from followers, people on social media platforms. So Kat has said, I live in London and I'm trying for a baby, but I'm worried about what pollution levels might do to, you know, his or her health. Am I much better off moving outside of London? I mean, that's probably a very common question.
So I can't answer the question in terms of where someone should live.
Exactly.
And you know, London does get in the news a lot because of its pollution levels. Mm. But other cities in the UK are, depending on where you are, just as or not much less polluted than London.
I'm sure.
There are some studies that have documented the effects of pollution on unborn babies.
Oh.
And so they suggest that babies who are born to mothers in more polluted areas may be born slightly preterm.
Oh, gosh.
They may be born slightly lower weight.
Mm.
And they may have a slightly smaller either length or head circumference, depending on what you measure. These are not big differences.
No. You know,
they're not big differences at all.
Okay.
But they are differences that have been noted in the literature. Some of them in this country, many of them abroad.
Yeah.
So, but it's important to remember that there are all sorts of other effects on health as well.
Of course. We don't want to scare
No, not at all.
Important to know that I think, Kat, that yes, of course, pollution affects it. So maybe just change the way you walk to work if you've got that, or try and minimise exposure, perhaps.
If it was me, I would enjoy having a child, and I might think about walking a different route to work if it didn't
exactly.
put me out of.
Yeah.
You know, out of my daily routine.
Yeah, we've got to be realistic. Margaret has said, this is the question I asked earlier about the air purifier at home. Was it worth the money? So I think we've kind of covered that question.
Look, if it makes someone feel happier in their
yes.
home, right, and it means they're worrying less.
Yeah. I agree. Happy life. Happy life. Happy forever. Robbie has said, do plants inside my house help reduce pollution levels?
That's a really complicated question.
Ooh.
So there is the effect of plants potentially cleaning the air. And certainly there's plants can act as barriers, you know, potentially if you have them near an open window, some leaves can trap particulates, depending on what the plant is. It depends on, you know, what kind of whether the surface of the leaf is hairy or smooth or waxy or what have you.
Ah.
there is also some evidence that plants can generate certain pollutants.
Oh, okay.
So some of the chemicals in diesel exhaust can react with chemicals from plants and produce new pollutants.
Oh, my goodness. Who'd have thought?
Again, what I will say is that there is really good evidence out there about the effect of mainly green space, as it's called, parkland, and even plants, having plants around, on well-being.
Yeah.
So if it was me... Yeah. If I liked having plants in my house and I didn't have hay fever, I'd have plants.
Oh, yeah, that's the thing, the hay fever. And if I were, you know, not so busy, I could actually water them. That's my thing.
Yeah.
Plants die in my house, unfortunately. okay, so the last question. Aston has said, you know, I've just come back from China and everyone was wearing these masks. So do you think I should be wearing masks when I'm cycling or in the UK? Does it actually have any impact?
In short, no. There's not a huge amount of work out there in the literature. There's a few papers that have looked at all sorts of different masks.
Yes.
And they tend to look at them in the more polluted cities. So actually, one of the studies that springs to mind was actually done in, I think it was in Beijing.
Yeah.
And they found that they studied all sorts of masks. So the surgical masks that people wear or just having a cotton handkerchief in front of your mouth.
I've seen that a lot.
Well, yeah. And most of these things don't work. They have found that there are a couple of masks and they tend to be the ones worn by paint sprayers and carpenters.
Of course.
They may have a small beneficial effect.
Yeah, it's better to wear it than not, I suppose.
Well, so that's if they're properly fitted, if you don't have any facial hair.
Yeah. Of
course, if they don't fit properly and they impede
facial hair, is that because it will trap all the particles?
So these some of the particles, the very smallest ones, we're talking about... 100 nanometers, which is about a 10,000th of a millimeter.
Oh, gosh.
So they're so small that if you have a little gap, they'll just get in anyway. Mm. I would say that if it makes someone feel safer, it makes someone feel more protected, then whatever someone wants. But personally, I think they're both probably not particularly effective.
Yeah.
And also not the right way to go about it. We should be looking more at the sources of pollution rather
prevention.
Than protecting it. And also, how would it feel if you were walking down the street and everyone was wearing a mask?
I know.
It'd be a bit scary. The other thing to say is that what I will say is that all of these studies on masks have been done in healthy people.
Ooh.
No one's actually studied, as far as I'm aware, whether they have any protective effect on people who've got underlying...
Yeah, predisposing illnesses, okay.
Probably because it's not very ethical to get someone who you think might have an adverse reaction and shove them outside and say,
of course.
You know, go and have a walk around.
With
so,
the fumes.
Exactly.
No, very good point. Well, thank you for that, Matthew. We're now moving on to my favourite part of the podcast. This is our fact or fiction quickfire round.
Sounds like my least favourite.
Okay, so you either answer fact or fiction as quickly as you can, but no pressure. It's all a good bit of fun.
Are these questions where you know the answer?
Well, the answer may not be fact or fiction. It's up to you. You know, I'm not saying that I'm the expert here. Okay, number one, joggers inhale more pollution than those walking the same distance.
If they're in the same area, then fact.
Pollution does more harm than smoking.
To the global population, the numbers suggest yes, but to individuals, it depends whether you smoke or not.
Mm.
To people who smoke, definitely not.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. Scented candles are 100% safe to use in the home.
From the evidence I've seen, no.
And I love scented candles, Matthew. Oh, pollution makes us age.
There's some evidence that it does, but the amount to which it makes us age, I don't really know. There's some evidence that it might cause wrinkles and some cosmetic skin effects, but I'm not sure.
Okay, well, face masks protect you against pollution.
Some pollution, moderately, perhaps. Do I wear one? No. Would I wear one? No.
There we go. I think that says it all. Exposure to pollution reduces fertility in men and women. Ooh. They're hard questions.
I've seen some anecdotal evidence that it might have small effects, but really I'm not up on the literature enough to be able to answer that authoritatively.
Ooh. Carrying a child rather than walking can reduce the exposure to pollution.
I presume you mean of the child?
Yes.
Okay. I suppose if the child is, if the child would have been walking next to the road.
Yeah.
So between the parent and the road, then
that's
possibly,
what I'm going
yes.
for. Okay, there we go. Gosh, it's a good arm workout. Air pollution is making climate change worse. Oh, climate change is the debate.
I mean, yes, although there are some air pollutants that are bad for health but good for the climate.
But
in general, yes. The overriding direction is yes.
Diesel exhaust can cause cancer.
True. Yeah, that's beyond doubt.
Yeah.
You know, scientists will always say maybe, might, perhaps. Yeah, diesel exhaust is carcinogenic, yeah.
There you go. Gosh. Pollution's effects are irreversible.
Some of them yes, some of them no.
Okay, well done. That's our quick fire round.
Thank you.
I'm blown away by a lot of these answers. It just makes me feel like I need a whole podcast just on maybe anti-aging and pollution and all these fascinating areas.
You know, it's a potentially a money spinning area, although I'm not really sure that there's much evidence for.
Well, there's lots of people making money off it already,
I think you're
right there. So that nearly wraps up this episode. But as with every guest, we finish with a food for thought. So mine today would be that although so many of us are becoming conscious of the impact of our diets, the reality is we actually have less healthy food, fiber, vitamins, minerals, and hydration than ever before, and it's really taking a toll on the environment. What's interesting is that a sustainable diet is one with low environmental impact, contributing to food and nutrition security, and is linked to healthy lives for a present and future generation. So here's a few things that I've learned to consider when trying to eat a more sustainable diet that you guys at home may want to try yourselves. So the first one would be enjoy a wide variety of food. Really test yourself to try something new each week. Consume minimally processed foods like whole grains, legumes, fruit and veg. But don't be scared of a few cans and things as well. There's nothing harmful with a can of chickpeas, guys. Balance your energy in and energy out because that depends on your activity levels each day. Enjoy dairy and dairy alternatives in moderation. Try unsalted seeds and nuts instead of the flavoured types. Basically mix it up a lot. Experiment with varied fish types, not just one species. Limit food considered high in fat, sugar and salt, and that's definitely for overall health benefits. Get a lot more healthy omega fatty acids because we know that olive oil is heavily researched in the Mediterranean diet. Enjoy more water over other drinks. So I'm talking about your fizzy drinks, your soft drinks, all that kind of stuff there, and eat animal produce like meat in moderation. So in fact, if we could all do the above that I've just listed, we would reduce our carbon footprint by 22% if we reduced meat intake to less than 90 grams per person per day. So there's actually quite a lot of research now out there about diet. But if I could let you, Matthew, share with everyone, putting you on the spot, just one take-home message, and obviously you must talk about this all the time back in the University of Southampton, if you have one food for thought, what would that be?
I'd say that we hear a lot in the press, seemingly more and more by the week, about air pollution and the damage it does to us. And while some of this is true, I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that our bodies are actually quite resilient, especially if they're in a good state. I think people should try and live a life which they feel is healthy. You know, and a lot of the good aspects of avoiding air pollution can include things like walking in parks, green space, going down to the river. You know, areas where there is less air pollution. So really, I'd be aware of air pollution, but I wouldn't worry about it and I wouldn't let it rule my life.
Oh, that's the best food for thought. And it's given me a little bit of a relief because, to be honest with you, this is an episode that I've been wanting from day one. And I'm so happy that we found you. And thank you so much, Matthew, for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to what is the last episode in Series 2. It's heartening to know there's such a craving to hear from expert voices in a world full of confusing nutritional advice. Your 5-star ratings and positive reviews have been so wonderful to read. And if you're keen for me to continue this podcast and record a Series 3 of Food for Thought, please do subscribe so that we can reach even higher highs in the charts, helping more people to listen in and make informed choices about their health and well-being. For more information about my Retrition clinic, books, healthy recipes, events, retreats, and so much more, please please visit Retrition.com and follow me at Retrition on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. If you believe that healthy eating is expensive, you're not alone. The BBC say up to 80% of the UK struggle to afford healthy food. But let me assure you, it just isn't true. And importantly, cheap does not necessarily mean unhealthy. Yet one food I cannot defend is cheap sausages. You know the ones I mean. Seriously, buy the food you can afford and enjoy it, but if you love sausages, you'll love heck. There's chicken, pork, veggie, and all sorts of varieties in your local supermarket, or check out heckfood.co.uk. And remember, when it comes to sausages, the healthiest tend to be those with a high meat or veg content, because it usually means there's less unnecessary stuff being used to bulk them out.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.